Speaking of your prescience, it was in January 2003 at the Herzliya Conference, just after, a few weeks after the elections in Turkey. And you got up on the stage and you said, this is a terrible outcome. Turkey is about to fall into the hands of the Islamists. And I remember the audience not exactly booing you, but there were a lot of cynical remarks, questions, oh, you go too far. Well, given what has happened with Turkey, especially over the last year, could you address that? How did you know?
I see Islamism as the third of three radical utopian movements: fascism, Marxism, and Islamism. And the first two did not learn. They stuck with their brutal, violent, totalitarian ways to the end. China and Vietnam may be exceptions, but they're no longer really Marxists, so they don't count. But the Islamists have quite rapidly learned and made progress, and they're not making the same mistakes today as that they made 30 years ago. So if the paradigm of the first generation of Islamist takeover was Khomeini, with a revolution, violence, repression, the model of the second form of Islamist takeover is Erdogan and democracy, legitimacy, working through the system. More specifically, they learned from their mentor, a man by the name of Erbakan, Erdogan and Erbakan. Erbakan had been the leader of the Islamists since the 1970s. Indeed, he was part of the government in the mid-1970s. And by the fluke of Turkish electoral politics, which I find quite odd, he ended up being prime minister in 1996. And symbolically, the first place that Erbakan went was to Libya. And he pursued an Islamist policy that was just unacceptable to the military. And within a year, he was out of office. And his lieutenants, in particular Erdogan and Gül and others, learned from this and realized they shouldn't be so blatant. They should be more careful. And they founded their new party in August of 2001. And they didn't use Islamic symbology, and they were much more careful. And in coming to office, the first country that Erdogan visited was Greece. And they were convincing to many people that they were the Muslim equivalent of Christian Democrats, but they weren't. They were who they were. They had not changed. And it took some years for this to become fully evident. I think today it is. I don't think anyone can have a doubt, whether it be domestic or foreign policy, that there is an Islamist government in Turkey. So in brief, to answer your question, it was clear that Erdogan had learned to change tactically. And it was also clear that this was convincing to virtually every government. And even today, and the referendum that took place, 3 days ago, which is a major development, was welcomed by the EU. The US government was fairly neutral on it, but the EU was welcoming it. This was a major step towards pushing the military out of politics and establishing Islamist rule. Let me just conclude by saying that there'll be elections in Turkey by next July. And if the AKP, the ruling party, wins that, Turkey's gone. It's Islamist. And judging by the 58-42 vote on Sunday, looks like they will win. But that's the key. If they lose that, then there's still a chance that it won't go Islamist. But if they do, I think the military will not intervene. And in effect, what you have is an Erdogan era that will undo the Atatürk era. Atatürk was just 15 years, from 1923 to 1938, making Turkey a Western country in many ways. And now Erdogan is making it an Islamist country. And it's quite remarkable how malleable Turkey is. It can be changed in profound ways by politicians acting from the top.
Well, what you're describing about Turkey can be said about Iran as well, that Khomeini came along and he undid all of the westernization that the Shah had introduced, or the Shah's father, who actually was a big fan of Ataturk. Well, is there any hope for countries that are finished like that? And what does that mean for the region?
I think Turkey and Iran are the two most important Muslim states, not just the Middle East, but everywhere. Pakistan and Saudi Arabia might be the next two. But Turkey and Iran are very interesting as a pair, because here you had a Ataturk revolution, low those 80 years ago, and now being undone. And in Iran you had an Islamic revolution by Khomeini 30 years ago, and it's too being undone. And they're crossing. The trouble is that Turkey is a democracy, and you know, we talk about referenda and elections, whereas Iran is an autocracy, a tyranny, really, and ever more so. And it's unclear that the vox populi will be heard, and unclear how many years, even decades, the ruling elite can stay in power. But Iran is the only place on the planet Earth where Islamism is in decline. And its overthrow will be a singular event in the evolution of radical Islam. And yet, it's not about to happen. It doesn't seem to be anyway, because the regime is doing what it must to stay in power.
Well, how can we respond to the fact that President Obama did not reach out to the demonstrators right after the Iranian elections that were basically stolen by Ahmadinejad? Should he not have then cultivated those forces that were fighting the Islamists?
It's a little embarrassing to have Merkel and Sarkozy and Brown condemn the Iranian regime and not Obama. It's a reversal from prior years. Well, there was a logic to Obama's policy, which is that the main issue is the nuclear weapons buildup. And it's important to have good relations, or decent relations, not antagonistic relations, or more than necessary antagonistic relations, with the ruling faction, and therefore stay away from endorsing or supporting the street demonstrators. I don't agree with it, but I can understand why it was done. It didn't do any good. It didn't lead to any useful conclusions, but there was a reason for it. Unfortunately, that same approach of not criticizing the Iranian regime or other dictatorial regimes tends to be the Obama administration policy over and over again. And the ever receding hope that this will lead to some benefit, I can't see that it has. On the other hand, Bush's policy, which lasted about 3 years from 2003 to 2006 of going for elections, also didn't have great results. Hamas was the symbol of the result of elections. So I think one needs something a little more nuanced than either of these positions. Something in between. Yes, democracy. Democracy is the goal. But slowly, slowly, modestly, carefully. Not so quickly. Not so Americanly. Slowly. Not 22 months between the overthrow of Saddam Hussein and the first elections for prime minister. But decades. 22 years. And you start with dog catcher and municipal councils, and then you build up. It was just done too fast. It was the right idea. It was good idea, but poor implementation. Obama has a bad idea and poor implementation. So.
Speaking of which, you have been very critical of what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. Could you elaborate on that, why you think that it's been a failure rather than, let's say, a slow-moving success?
Well, I endorsed both the expeditionary forces to Afghanistan and Iraq and the overthrow of their respective governments, which were abominable and dangerous. But I thought in both cases, especially the Iraqi, where the United States and its allies invested much more, I thought we should have overthrown the regime and basically handed the keys to the kingdom to the Iraqis and Afghans, and had some troops there, but in the deserts, remote, and said, good luck. I think that what the Bush administration tried to do was too ambitious, again, too American. It implicitly took the model of 1945, with all its many important differences, and applied it to these two countries. And said, well, we Americans rehabilitate countries. We take our defeated foes and we put them on their feet and send them on their way. Well, you don't always succeed at that. And we didn't here. And it was clear from the beginning that we didn't have the will. And they weren't even defeated. They were liberated. And it wasn't going to work. My prediction now, and I'm sorry to make this prediction, I hope I'm wrong, is that both Afghanistan and Iraq are doomed in the sense that our $1 trillion, our 4,500 deaths will have been seen in retrospect as wasted, will not have achieved anything. In other words, the regimes that are there, the Maliki regime, the Karzai regime, are puppet, not puppets, just wrong, kept regimes. They make their own decisions, but they are there by virtue of the support of coalition forces. And take those away and the regimes will fall, especially given the Iranian and Pakistani interests in these two countries. So I'm very pessimistic. And I might also add that I see Mahmoud Abbas as a kept politician, with that Israeli security support and foreign monies, he would be gone. So even Hariri in Lebanon to some extent is. So in 2000 there were no kept politicians, and now there are three or even arguably four. I don't think that's a healthy development. You want real political leaders, not ones that rest on foreign bayonets.
Well, now I'm not going to let you just sort of let that one go, since we have no choice but to talk about Abbas and Bibi and what's going on right now with these talks. I would assume, given what you just said, that you're not overly optimistic about the chances for success in this millionth peace process, quote unquote.
No, I'm not. As you might imagine. I think there's 0% chance that this will resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict. But I think there's a much higher chance that we'll be seeing some kind of signing ceremony, you know, with Abbas here and Netanyahu here and aides bringing the books and so forth. I can certainly see that. For two reasons. One is that the U.S. and other governments have put great pressure on both parties to do so. And although neither party wants to, they're, you know, doing what they have to do. And secondly, I can see it because I think there's a possible deal. The Israeli priority is clearly Iran, and the American priority is clearly the Palestinians. And you might wonder, why should the American priority be the Palestinians? Well, it's a concept that has come to be known as linkage. Linkage is not so primitive as to say that everything in the Middle East is a result of the Arab-Israeli conflict, but it does say, Martin Indyk would be a good exponent of it, it does say that everything in the Middle East is made worse because of the Arab-Israeli conflict. Democracy and tyranny and economic development and getting a coalition versus Iran and much more, all this is imperiled by virtue of the Arab-Israeli conflict. Therefore, if you want to address the problems of the Middle East, you start with apartments in Jerusalem. And that's why Palestinians are the priority, because the Palestinians are the key or the entryway to all these other questions. So I see a possible deal whereby the Israeli government makes concessions against its better judgment, knowing that these are futile and counterproductive, in order to get perhaps some concessions on, or promises on Iran.
When you say promises or concessions, do you mean, for example, some kind of permission to bomb Iran, the Iranian nuclear facilities? And if so, can we really expect a prime minister who sent the army in with paintball guns to handle the Turkish flotilla, someone who's going to bomb Iran?
Well,
that was a leading question.
Beyond the character of the prime minister is the question of whether Israeli forces have the ability. From what I understand, there are 30 to 40 meter concrete caps on top of the nuclear infrastructure, which implies to me that the only way to take out the nuclear infrastructure is with nuclear bombs, which is something even more of a giant step than...
You mean not regular bunker busters? They wouldn't do
that? Well, I'm no specialist in this area, but I find it hard to imagine that conventional bombs could penetrate. I mean, think of it, 30, 40 meters of reinforced concrete. Hard to imagine that being penetrated by conventional weapons. So I don't know. I don't know what exactly it is. Would it be American assurances that there won't, that the Iranian regime will not be allowed to do this? Some kind of nuclear umbrella, which doesn't really make sense to me, but maybe over Israel. Permission? I don't know. But there's a possibility of a deal there. That's all I'm saying. I'm not doing this on the basis of inside knowledge, but just looking at the structural. The structure of these negotiations. The Israelis want this, the Americans want that, maybe they'll make a deal.
Now, you were just discussing sort of America's, I would say, lack of understanding. I'm paraphrasing you, not quoting you. Lack of understanding about dealing with the Middle East and democratizing the Middle East. If so, let's suppose a deal could be struck between Abu Mazen and Bibi, that involved, I suppose, massive territorial concessions on Israel's part. Is there any chance of dealing with the Palestinian Authority from a Western perspective to encourage democracy any better than in Iraq and Afghanistan? Do you see that as a possibility?
I don't think the Palestinians are ready for democracy. And if you want to have an argument, I point to the 2005 elections in the West Bank and Gaza. I see democracy as I do capitalism and freedom of speech. The essential elements of modern liberal democracy, modern liberal order, as being counterintuitive. Capitalism is not intuitive. Intuitive is the idea that zero-sum transaction. I win, you lose. Capitalism is I win, you win. Freedom of speech is counterintuitive. The truth should be allowed and falsehood should be prohibited. A democracy is counterintuitive. You should have a philosopher king, someone who's really smart, take over. And so all of these are learned habits, and they take a long time to learn. If you look historically, I don't know, between the Magna Carta and the Reform Bill in Britain was, 500-some years. And in the United States, it was decades and decades. And elsewhere, I don't know, Taiwan or Turkey, it takes decades. It takes a while. That's why my comment before about Iraq, 22 months was too fast. The Iraqis would come out of a Stalinist order, the most antithetical to modern liberalism, of modern liberal order, they're not ready for it, and neither the Palestinians. So I think it has to be done slowly and gradually, as I said, voting for municipal town council and the legislative branch, and then followed eventually by the executive branch, and up and up and up, governors, and then finally the prime minister. But you don't start with the election for the top figure. It's a process of building civil society, rule of law, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of movement, loyal opposition. I mean, how counterintuitive is the notion of a loyal opposition? All these are sophisticated notions that have to be learned over time. Palestinians are not ready for it.
at the risk of sounding like the right-wing fanatic that I am, I have to ask you, if democracy is possible given the teachings of the Quran?
Yes. Democracy is possible anywhere. There is no reason to think that, say, Japan could ever be democratic. There was nothing whatsoever democratic in the history of Japan. But it became democratic in the Japanese way, which is different from others, but it did become. I think there's nothing antithetical to democracy in Islam. What we're seeing, I would prefer to look at history than theology. I'd prefer to look at how Muslims got to where they are today than to look at sacred books dating back a millennium and more. One finds that sacred books, religions, can be read in different ways at different times and are malleable. And I see no reason why Muslims can't be. And I think that should be a goal, is helping Muslims get to the point to modernize so that they are democratic.
The question, though, is, I mean, if you take Jews and Judaism as an example of ancient texts and modern people, and, you know, two Jews, three opinions, we're not really seeing that in the Muslim world at the moment. There is only, I would say, a handful of people speaking out, Muslims, speaking out against this. And maybe there are millions out there who don't agree with radical Islam, but we're not hearing their voices.
Right. If we had this conversation in 1942 when we were discussing Germany, you'd be pointing out to me that Germany was never really democratic, and yeah, there was this Weimar Republic that was imposed from the outside, and this is the real Germany that we're seeing today. It'll never be, there's a thousand-year Reich coming up, it'll never be democratic. And I'd say, you know, it's history. We can help the Germans become democratic, and I would be right and you would be wrong. And I would say the same thing now. There is no reason to extrapolate from the past to the future. Or to put it differently, I am, as you heard, a historian. And I think the fundamental insight of the historian is that things change over time. And one shouldn't take today's circumstances, project it backwards, and extrapolate it to the future. There's no reason to assume that what is will be. And yes, this is a terrible moment in the history of the Muslim peoples. In fact, it's the worst ever moment. But it doesn't mean, it doesn't mean if it goes down and got worse, it can go up and get better. Let's try and make it better.
Though the examples you gave of Germany and Japan, the one sort of missing element here is that Germany and Japan were both defeated by the United States. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, the United States and Russia and many other countries. I want to defeat radical Islam. We defeated fascism in World War II, we defeated communism in the Cold War, and now I'd like to defeat Islamism. That's my goal. There's a lot of talk about peace. Everybody wants peace, except your mother. I'm interested in victory. And then we define the peace. I mean, if you went to the Soviet Union in the old days, it was peace, 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 mir, 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 everything was mir. You start thinking, you know, Soviets want peace. Well, actually, everybody wants peace. They want peace on their terms. Well, me too, I want peace on my terms. And that means winning.
What constitutes defeat when you're not talking about a country, but rather a religion, a widespread religion?
Well, one interpretation of a religion. I prefer to see Islamism, as you heard me before, put in the context of fascism and communism. That's my triad, not Islamism, Christianity, Judaism. No. Islam, Christianity, but not Islamism. Islamism is a radical utopian ideology that developed in the 1920s, in large part admiring Mussolini, to a lesser extent admiring Lenin and Stalin. It developed at a time when it appeared that the wave of the future would be totalitarian control. And various Muslim leaders such as Banna in Egypt and Khomeini in Iran and Maududi in India were inspired by this, to apply these same methods to their own civilization. And the result is what you see today.
how can you defeat Islamism in so many different countries? I mean, other than invading all of those countries. And some of those countries are temporarily allies, for example, in the war, or the war that's not happening, against Iran, like Saudi Arabia. How do you attack something that doesn't have borders? I mean, I know you say the Cold War also, you could say, didn't have borders. There were communists all over the world. Isn't this a little more tricky than that?
And we didn't attack in the Cold War either. The Soviet Union imploded. And I believe that Iran, left to its own devices, will implode as well. Could be a long way off, but it will implode. The implication there is that if you have an experiment with communism or Islamism and presumably fascism, then eventually people don't want it and repudiate it and get rid of it. But that's an awfully slow and expensive method. So are there ways to defeat Islamism without having everybody experience it for some decades? Yeah, I think there is. And the way I would suggest is to help those Muslims who have an alternate vision of what it means to be a Muslim. In other words, I see a civil war taking place in the Muslim world in which only one side has turned up reported for duty, and that's the Islamist. The other side barely exists, is intimidated and fractured, weak, and our only chance is to help it grow. And there are two elements here. One are the activists and politicians, the leaders, and the other the thinkers, the Quranic who will reinterpret the Hadith, the Quran, sacred scriptures in a modern way. But it's going to take time, and they're weak, and it's theoretical. What's interesting actually is that from about the time of Napoleon's invasion in 1798 till the 1930s, the Muslim world looked to Britain and France and emulated them and had a liberal period. So if you went exactly 100 years back to 1910, you would see such reformists and exciting things happening in reform Islam. I mean, there was a lot of work done. And indeed, as late as the 1960s, when I started in this field, that's all that we studied when it came to modern Islam. The Islamists, the Muslim Brethren. There was one book on the Muslim Brethren. There was one book in English. That's it. No one paid attention to it. Everybody wrote and thought and discussed the reformers, exactly the people that I'm hoping will emerge, the people trying to reconcile Islam with modernity. Book after book after book, that's all I read about in my student days with the reformers. And of course they've disappeared. Nobody thinks of them anymore. But there is not only the possibility, but there's actually a heritage of a century plus thinking that's now completely defunct and ignored, but it's there as a base for reestablishing this sort of thought. And some exciting things took place, but the Islamists came in and wiped it out.
Well, I have two questions about that. And one is, you say it takes time, and that's for sure, but, you know, we really don't have time if Iran, John Bolton recently said that we had 8 days. That was about 2 weeks ago. Israel certainly doesn't have time for Iran to have nuclear bombs. That's number one. The other question is, in order to, let's say, cultivate all those reformers that you were studying and you say are out there and exist, isn't the West going about that in exactly the opposite way by talking about multiculturalism, accepting Islamist, not Muslim, traditions, by defending the rights, I don't know, of Saudis to not allow women to have driver's license, to defend female circumcision? The West are the ones cultivating the leaders of those countries who are.
Good point. On your first question, well, we're talking about Islam, not Iranian nuclear installations.
Okay.
Different subjects.
Okay.
About how Muslims understand the religion is different from what you do with building nukes. On the second, yes, we are going about it the wrong way, and for the reasons you point out, we are ready to work with the Islamists so long as they're nonviolent. There was a key speech made in the United States in 1992 by Assistant Secretary of State Edward Djerejian, which not only influenced U.S. policy, but other governments' policy and non-governmental policy. And what he laid out was a distinction between violent and non-violent Islamists. And he said, non-violent Islamists are our enemy. Non-violent Islamists we can work with. We've got no problem with them. And that has been universally the standard policy in Western countries, non-Muslim countries. In Muslim countries, that's not the case. There's much more severe. That policy is wrong-headed and is leading, precisely as you say, to the inclusion of the Islamists and the exclusion of the true moderates. True moderates are despair because they see the Islamists being... I'll give you an example. Hours after the 7/7 bombings in Britain, Tony Blair got on television, major speech, and he thanked the Muslim Council of Britain. Well, just a few weeks earlier, the head of it had been knighted by the Queen, and the Prime Minister then thanked it. This is an Islamist organization. And if you're anti-Islamist, what are you going to do? The Queen and the Prime Minister are celebrating this leading Islamist organization. They despair. They're exactly the wrong thing to do. And so much of my time and energy is devoted to trying to alert not just governments, but institutions, individuals, about the need to not only pay attention to violent Islamism, but also nonviolent. It's easy to pay attention to violent Islamism. Things go exploding, you notice it. And it's easy to hate it, kill people. But the nonviolent type is harder to see, and much more subtle. And why should people get exercised over what? There's so many examples. Why should people get exercised that in Britain it's now legal to have polygamous marriages? It's a rather minor thing, isn't it? It doesn't hurt anybody. But it is a profound shift. In some ways it's much more important than killing 52 people. It is a profound shift in the nature of British life. If you're going to have polygamy, you have a different order. These are the sort of things that I'm trying to argue, and they're hard. They're tough to convince people of.
Well, speaking of which, how much, now you're mentioning Britain and polygamy, and in Israel, we're always yammering about the demographic problem on this side or that side of the political spectrum. What about Europe's demographic problem?
Well, the Europeans are having roughly two-thirds of the number of children they need to have, which is, say, 1.45 children per woman instead of 2.1. And obviously this has many implications, but the most evident one is that the Europeans have built up a vast social structure of payments, of pensions and the like, and somebody's got to keep it going. And so there's an urge to have immigrants do that. But the Europeans don't have any immigration policy. The Australians are really the only ones who have a debate over immigration policy. I don't know anyone else who does. And certainly the Europeans don't. And whoever turns up comes by some little craft onto the Canary Islands is in Europe, or swims around the fence at Ceuta and Melilla, these are two small Spanish enclaves in Morocco, is in Europe, is in the Schengen sphere, and that's it. And that person is probably not going to be a productive laborer, and to an astounding extent. The Muslim immigrants of Europe tend to be not productive. Indeed, there's now a major brouhaha in Germany over a just-published book by stalwart of the Labour Social Democrat Party, yeah, named Thilo Sarrazin, who makes this point. And it's a furor in Germany over the, these are taboo subjects. But in fact, he's right. You know, this is the economic future of Europe is not going to work depending on this kind of immigrant labor.
But not just, but immigration isn't the only way the population increases. There's childbirth. I think Muslims tend, or religious people tend to have more children. And Europeans, as you say, seem not to be having children. So isn't this a danger for the future of policies like Sharia, like having Sharia law spread all over Europe because of the numbers?
There certainly is a correlation between religiosity and children. And Christianity has, to a large extent, collapsed in Europe. And they are correlated. As for the future, I think there are three major possibilities. One is that everybody gets along, Muslims and indigenous Europeans, and everything works out fine. And this is the default position of most Europeans. They just assume this is going to somehow work itself out. I don't see it that way. I see that there are two major possibilities that are likely. One is an extension of what has happened over the last 50-some years, which is more Muslims and more Islamization, more Sharia. Just more and more and more, ending up with the Notre Dame Mosque of Paris. And the other is that Europeans say, no, we don't like this. We reject this Islamization. We like who we are. And all over Europe, many parts of Europe, one sees budding parties and organizations that defy Islam, hate the whole concept and presence, and are making waves in the Netherlands. The PVV, Geert Wilders Party, is number three and looks to be part of the ruling coalition, though I'm formally just supporting it, not a formal member. And I think I mentioned that there are elections in Sweden coming up, where the Swedish Democratic Party may be the pivotal party between the two blocks. And this is, if that happens, this will be a revolution for Sweden. It's never had anything like this before. But I think these are precursors of further such developments throughout Europe, where Islam is the issue. And I don't know which way it's going to go, whether Eurabia, as it's called, the extension of Islam, or this rejection. I think it's too early to predict, but I think we'll know before too many years. There'll be enough controversies and fights that we'll know which way Europe is going. Either way is not very attractive, rather bleak. I think Europe has real problems ahead.
Okay, now one last question before we open the floor to questions. So let's go across the ocean to the United States. You're talking about, you know, Europeans now grappling with this issue. Meanwhile, there's a controversy in New York over building an Islamic center at Ground Zero. And Abe Foxman of the Anti-Defamation League, who opposed it, quickly, a few days later, joined an interfaith group that whose purpose is to help build mosques all over the country. Could you address that?
Yeah, it's been quite a phenomenon. Let me start by noting that in many Western countries, the great ruckus over Islam tends to be symbolic rather than real. It's not over an issue like polygamy, which just happens, which I think is enormously profound. It happens over minarets in Switzerland and hijabs in schools, and, you know, hijabs are women's head covers, in France, cartoons in Denmark. You know, not the real key issues. And thus, in the United States, this mosque, well, community center, you might say. And it has, I think, it looks like, changed the American attitude towards, or it's brought out, it changed American attitude towards Islam. Much tougher and quite anti-Islamic as Josiah mentioned in his introduction, the sentiments that one's hearing are just anti-Islamic. And these, by the way, are sentiments that one found in Europe a decade ago, were quite prevalent, but were almost non-existent in the United States. And now they are strong, they are articulated by television hosts, radio talk show hosts, politicians, authors, bloggers, and so forth. It's all around. And I might say from a personal point of view, whereas a decade ago, all the criticism of me was from the left, say, from multiculturalists, Islamists, and so forth. Now, virtually all the criticism comes from the right, from people who say that I'm too soft, and so forth. It's quite a change. And I've been called a Vimy, and I've been called, and so forth. But I think not only is it if you're anti-Islam, what are you going to do? I mean, there's no policy that can come out of that. What are you going to do? Kill all Muslims? Quarantine all Muslims? Convert all Muslims? These are not policies that a modern Western country can adopt. We're not crusading states. So if you're anti-Islamic, there's nothing you can do. And one of the interesting things about Wilders is that I expect he will have basically no impact on the Dutch government to come. There's nothing that they can do that will... I mean, you can't put a head tax, you can't ban the Quran. You can't put a head tax on hijabs. His notions are completely impractical. You can't ban Muslims from entering the country. These are not steps that any Western country can take. So it's impractical. There's no policy here that can come of it. And secondly, whereas my point of view, which sees Islamism and the tradition of fascism and communism, we defeat some Muslims. And second point is, I want to work with Muslims to do this. As Josiah quoted me, radical Islam is the problem and moderate Islam is the solution. I want to work with Muslims to defeat Islamism. I don't think that you can defeat Islamism if you don't work with Muslims. What are you going to offer? How are you going to fight this battle? We who are not Muslims cannot offer an alternative to Islamism. It has to be Muslims who do that. So it's impractical and it's short-sighted. But it's satisfying emotionally, and that's what people are expressing. It's an emotional indulgence. I do hope that there will be an evolution and that this rather crude beginning leads to more sophisticated understanding later on. And that's what I see my role as being part of trying to teach people that. But that isn't where I was 10 years ago. That was not a concern at all. It's a brand new set of issues.
Okay, well, thank you, Daniel. So now we're opening up the floor for questions, and please make them questions and not monologues, all right? Okay, we'll start with you there. There's a microphone. Where's the mic? Oh, can you get over there? Fling it. Okay. There must be a button on it. No?
All right, I'll just speak loud.
Okay.
You mentioned working with modern...
Mic now.
Who is it?
We are experiencing technical
difficulties.
Okay, you mentioned working with moderate Muslims, but isn't it true that any outside force backing a moderate Muslim pretty much delegitimizes them by making them appear to be nothing but the puppets of the West? And therefore, what's the word? Takfir, I think is the term. So exactly how do you get around
that? That's the kiss of death question. If we help our friends, don't we delegitimate them? Well, we're not delegitimating the Islamists by working with them. I don't see that we necessarily would delegitimate the anti-Islamists. I do believe that we have something to offer them, that our funding, our applause, our legitimation, our giving them time on media, time in the schools would be enormously helpful. Now, granted, there'll be some people who might see that kind of sponsorship as delegitimating, but I don't think that's a serious problem. No.
Okay. Yes, you got it there.
Isn't one of the most important things that we can do to help moderate Islam is to stand against radical Islam, that is, to defeat them and frustrate them so that the broader Muslim audience sees that they are not the path to victory, and that's what will bring out the moderate Muslims.
Hi, Max. Yes, exactly. We should defeat the using all means, from fighter aircraft to radios to everything. Yes, I mean, in that sense, it's a little like the Cold War, as you noted earlier. Use everything, every tool at your disposal. You have an enemy, and you want to discredit it, and you use everything you have. And we have a lot. Now, the trouble is, I mentioned there's a Cold War in the Muslim world, but there's a Cold War in the Muslim world. There's also a Cold War in the Western world. Imagine that everyone were on the right. Imagine that everyone agreed that this is a problem. Imagine everyone agreed with me, what I just said. We would be very resolute and strong. We have everything at our disposal, from demographics, there's the whole non-Muslim world in some sense, to military means, economic means. We prevail in every aspect. But we're not agreed. And much of our time is engaged in intramural fighting between those who don't see this as a problem and those who do. And again, much of my time is spent on trying to figure out how does one get, in effect, the left to see that this is a problem. And it doesn't right now. And there's a significant alliance between the left and the Islamists. And interestingly, one finds this throughout the non-Muslim world, for example, a country like India. And one doesn't find it in the majority Muslim countries, for example, Turkey. If you want to vote against the Islamists in Turkey, you vote for the left. So that, I think, is very important. The left is opening doors and empowering the Islamists in the West, or the non-Muslim majority countries, in a way that's very, very damaging. And that's stymieing us. That's what's making it so difficult to have a consistent and effective policy.
Okay. Toby, wait, can you see? Oh, you can't see where I'm pointing. Okay. Here.
I want to ask the question about President Obama. Has he been able to articulate the idea of the Islamists and their derogatory and devastating policies effectively? If so, how has he done so? And if not, why has he not been able to do so?
I actually see quite a bit of continuity between Bush and Obama on the question of Islam. Days after the 9/11 attacks, Bush said that Islam is a religion of peace. And he started the tradition of having an iftar, breaking the Ramadan fast in the White House. He appointed a special envoy to the Organization of the Islamic Conference, and on and on. And Obama hasn't really changed that. He's made it sound like he's changed that, had these major speeches in Istanbul and Cairo, and talks endlessly about mutual respect. The first interview he gave as president was to Al Arabiya, a television channel. But in substance, it's quite similar. And not just that, but in substance, say, Iraq and Afghanistan are quite similar. He didn't repudiate the Bush plans. He's inherited them and is doing roughly the same as Bush would have done. So what's so interesting is that you put this together And you see that while Bush had very low polling numbers in the Muslim world, and Obama's went dramatically up, or Obama dramatically brought them up on becoming president, they've even since gone right back down, and they're more or less where they were under Bush. So there's a lot of fluster and noise, but in substance and in response, things are not much changed.
All right. You can do one over there, and then we shouldn't, we should also have some from over here, I guess. Is there a way to do that? And then I have another one.
You spoke about Islamists and moderate Muslims, and I was wondering if you could first of all provide us with a definition of the two and give us an idea of what percentage we're speaking about worldwide and what attracts people to both. You said that Iran is the only country where there's decline.
Good basic questions. Islamism is, as I suggested before, a doctrine that developed in the 1920s, 30s, that sees Muslims gaining power and wealth by going back to their traditions, meaning full application of the Sharia and stringent application of the Sharia everywhere, on everyone, all the time. This is not the way Muslims live traditionally. It was much more nuanced and relative than this. Islamists brought a new, obviously new, tenor. Clearly, I mean, the difference between the Shah of Iran and the Khomeini was very substantial, or the Taliban in Pakistan and others. Very, very big difference. I estimate that the number of Muslims who want to apply the Sharia to themselves in the entire world is about 10 to 15%, 1 out of 8. There could be other indices such as attitudes towards Israel or Osama bin Laden, but I don't think those are the right ones. I think it's, do you want yourself and everyone else to live under the full weight of Islamic law, unadulterated Islamic law, in its completion? Your final question was, what attracts? That's very, very important. By and large, we live in a materialist society, a Marxist society, diluted Marxist society, where we assume that things are caused by economic motives. And that applies in this case, too. The default response of Westerners is that this must be due to poverty or stress of some sort, unemployment. And you know, you're not happy, so therefore you strap a bomb around your waist. But clearly a lot of people who are unemployed who do not do that. I am, in contrast, someone who believes in ideas. I believe you're not who you're not what you eat, you are what you think. And it's your thinking that is decisive. And to me, the key is a sense that the Muslim world, the Ummah, is doing badly, and it is doing badly. Certainly compared to a millennium ago, it's doing badly. And if you look at any international statistics, wealth and power and literacy and longevity and the like, doing badly. And the Muslims who look at this fact and want to do something about it, at this time, not 100 years ago, but at this time, say, application of Sharia will do it. That is what will make the Muslim world strong. It's the defense of the Ummah. And it's the prevalent, predominant understanding of how you make Muslims again strong and wealthy as they were a millennium ago. There are no other ideas out there at present. This dominates. And what's particularly striking is even if you're not Muslim, you might find these ideas. Take one example, John Walker Lynn, who was, you may recall, arrested in Afghanistan fighting for the Taliban in late 2001. He is a child, a flower child, or the child of flower children. Mother was a Buddhist, father worked for the telephone company in Marin County, north of San Francisco. He discovered Islam, and not just Islam, but Taliban Islam. So it's a powerful set of ideas, coherent, compelling set of ideas. And in this, again, it's comparable to fascism and communism, which appeal to the bright not to the lumpen proletariat, but to the achievers and the ambitious ones in society. They want to do something. They want a just society. They want to redeem the Muslim community, and this is the way to do it.
Okay, I'm gonna since the Is there a microphone?
Yeah. Okay. I was hoping for more clarity, which I think I got more from Ruthie's questions than from your answers. However, I think the idea that radical Islam is the problem and moderate Islam is the solution has been the most confusing idea that has come up in many, many decennies. And I think the most clear idea is that you said is how similar Islamism is to Nazism. And there are many analogies to be made, and I think my question is, what should the free world have done to stop Nazism before it was allowed to do the damage that it did?
If I might finesse your question, because it's really not my topic, but rather take up your confusion, it would be like saying Germans are not the enemy, Nazis are the enemy. And there was an idea in the 1940s that Germany is a hopeless country, has made so much trouble for the world, twice now in 20 years, Germany should be in some fashion obliterated. Made pre-industrial country, and that was analogous to saying that all Muslims are the enemy or the problem, and indeed it proved to be not correct. You can have a Germany that's modern and decent, and I believe one can have an Islam and Muslims that are modern and decent. I'm not quite sure why that's so confusing. I am saying that not all forms of Islam have to be oriented towards full implementation of the Sharia. Not all forms of Islam want to return to the medieval period. There are plenty of Muslims who don't want to do that. And indeed, there are some articulate, brave Muslims who are saying that all the time. There are not enough of them. They don't have enough power. They don't have enough money. Their organizations are inadequate, but they're there. And they are thinking. They are trying to look to the Quran and interpret it. They are looking at the Quran and interpreting it in different ways. Let me give you a favorite example of mine. There was a Sudanese thinker by the name of Muhammad Mahmoud Taha, who, symbolically enough, was executed by the regime in Sudan. So he failed. But his reading was an interesting one. In Muslim understanding, there are two parts of the Quran, the Meccan period and the Medinan period. And there are chapters from one and chapters from the other. And the former, the Meccan period, tends to be cosmological, full of grand statements. And the Medinan tend to be much more practical because Muhammad was a ruler then. And in general, the Medina verses abrogate the Meccan ones. When there's any kind of contradiction, Mecca, because they're later, Medinan, because they're later, have force of law in a way that the Meccans don't. And what this thinker Taha said is, oh, actually the Medina verses were meant for Medina for those 10 years, from 622 to 632. Mecca verses are for all time. So out go the entire body of Mecca verses, the Medina verses, and essentially out goes the whole Sharia. Now that's a very radical approach, and as I say, he was executed by the regime. But it's there. It's an idea that is available, that others can pick up on it. And I would like to help Muslims move, not necessarily that radical direction, but to move in the direction of not applying the Sharia in its completeness. See, take the Anglican Church. There's a huge debate in the Anglican Church over homosexuality. If you look at the Bible, it's perfectly clear to anyone who reads the Bible that the Bible condemns homosexuality. But yet there is a new reading of the Bible now that says, actually, no, it doesn't. And this is okay. And there's a great debate that may split the Anglican Church. This is essentially a debate over texts and over religion and over modernity. And that kind of debate is prevalent in Judaism and Christianity. It takes place all the time on all sorts of issues. It's not really taking place in Islam. Put it differently, all three monotheistic religions, 500 years ago, prohibited interest on money in some fashion and allowed and forced labor in some fashion, slavery. Well, Jews and Christians went through huge debates over these questions. We had a civil war in which 600,000 people died concerning slavery. Interest on money was a major debate in Renaissance Italy. Muslims haven't had those debates. There are now major institutions with deposits maybe up to $1 trillion that are without interest, la riba, no interest. And there are many countries in which there's slavery. Muslims have a lot of work ahead of them. And just because they haven't done it doesn't mean they can't do it, but there's a lot of work ahead. And I would like to move this process along and do what we can from the outside to encourage it.
Okay. Yes.
Would you please assess radical?
Would you assess radical Islam in the United States? Indicate whether it's growing, and then specifically mention how strong is it now on university and college campuses?
I would have said half a year ago that radical Islam is inexorably getting stronger in the United States, but because of this furor over the so-called Ground Zero Mosque, I think it's in retreat now. I think something deep has happened. It's a little early to predict, but that's what it feels like. That this delayed response to 9/11 has finally happened. As for universities and universities, the presence of Islamism is substantial, especially among students, not so much among faculty, where it's really the left, not the Islamists. But among students, it's growing all the time. And I think the university is usually a foretaste of what the future is going to look like, though I'm not sure in this case, but no question, the universities have an Islamist element that's much stronger than the society at large. That said, the United States is way laggard behind Europe. I would say the country that's most advanced in this regard is Britain. Britain is before our eyes becoming a different country. And you can go and look at stately houses and watch movies of Jane Austen, and all those things are still there. But they're not what's taking place today. Britain is changing. Sweden and Britain are the most advanced in terms of evolving into something very different from their historic nature.
Okay, one second. Over here. You were waiting.
You suggest that Islam can be, over time, democratized, and maybe history will prove you correct. But how would you explain that second and third and maybe even fourth generation French Muslims repudiate French democracy?
Well, I don't think there's any connection between those two. The original immigrants to the West tended to be apolitical, looking for jobs. They came in the 50s, 60s, 70s when Islamism was a much smaller force. And their children, for several reasons, have moved towards radical Islam. One is that it's in the air. It's much more powerful than it was earlier. The second is, particularly in Europe, it's hard to walk around being a Muhammad or a Fatma and get a job. Thirdly, the Europeans are not very assertive about their own civilization. There's a lot of mumbling and guilt of multiculturalism and the like. So as one Islamist in Britain said, how do you expect me to become British when you don't even believe in your own civilization? So, yes, that's a very important development, but I don't think in any way it argues against the possibility of a moderate Islam emerging. Is pointing to the fact that in Europe especially, it's not emerging, no. But it doesn't mean it can't emerge. And I think the United States is more likely to have it than Europe because the Muslims in the United States don't suffer, at least until now, from the same disabilities. Being Muhammad in the United States is a lot easier than being Muhammad in Germany.
Yes, you against the wall.
Thank you. You seem to narrow the discussion between radicalism and modernism. What about secularism as an alternative to be promoted?
Definitely. Well, under the rubric of moderate Islam, I mean anything that's against the Islamist ideology, and it could be, and I would hope it would be secular in the sense of separating religion from the politics. But I'm just making a generic reference to anything that rejects the emphasis on applying the Sharia stringently to everyone. I would hope it would be secular. I thought that Turkey was a model. Turkey was a model. I hoped it would become a model that others would follow. Unfortunately, no one liked Turkey in the Muslim world until Erdogan came along. Erdogan is the folk hero of the Arab world now. Quite amazing. They had no time for the Ataturkist. It did never become a model. And I think in part that's due to the Turks' inability to evolve Ataturkism. Ataturkism is a stagnant, stale ideology where you still are quoting things that Ataturk said in 1928, whereas the Islamists are fun and developing and exciting, cartoons and videos and online. And the Turks never had the idea, it was very Turkish-oriented, and the only peoples they thought of sending this to were in Central Asia, Turkic peoples. They didn't try and develop a more broadly based secular model for the Muslims as a whole. So that came and looks like it went without any further residue. But you know, these are the accidents of history. I don't think it was fated that way, and I don't think that implies that it doomed. It was working. And indeed, it was in large part, I referred earlier to the intricacies of Turkish political regulations. Let me be more explicit. In the Turkish parliament, you have to have 10%. Here it's what? 1%, now 2% to get to enter into the Knesset. But in Turkey, it's 10%. And in the key 2002 elections, the AKP got 34%, Ataturk's party, leftist party, the CHP got 12%, and all the rest, 54%, was wasted. One party got 9, one party got 8, one got 7, one got 6, and one got 5, literally. And so, in terms of seats, the Islamists, who only had 1/3 of the votes, had 2/3 of the seats, and the rest is history. So, you know, these things happen. They're not foreordained. I don't think this implies that Turkish electoral laws are irrelevant. They were very important to Erdogan and company coming to office. And I don't think one should be fatalistic about this and say, you know, democracy can't work in the Muslim world. I think it can. And to which I'd say to you, well, if you reject that, what is your plan? If you say that Islam is the problem, Islam can't change, every Muslim is an Islamist, every Muslim wants full application of Islamic law, then I say, what's your policy? Where are you going to go with that? Tell me. I don't see that there's any. And I have, for example, I've had some debates with Wafa Sultan, who takes that position very ardently and very eloquently. And she, in effect, says, well, there has to be some kind of reform Islam that emerges. I go, ah, okay. You have to have a policy. And so what I have said, for example, to some evangelical leaders is, look, I'm not going to try and argue I'm not going to try and convince you that Islam is not evil. You think that way, you're a mature person, I'm not going to convince you. But I can argue with you that that's not going to get you anywhere. You can't have a policy impact if you say Islam is evil. It doesn't get you anywhere. If you want to be a player in this game, if you want to have a role, you have to come my way.
Okay. Yeah, you here. Yes.
My question.
Oh, and I'm sorry, this is the last question before refreshments, so that's at least the good news. That's not
Well, my question harks back to what you said previously about what's happening in Great Britain, the country of my birth. It's unfair because you're a historian, not a psychologist. Can you give me any sort of explanation about how this has crept up, Islam's crept up in Britain like you have? You've got imams standing up in mosques saying publicly they're looking forward to seeing the flag of Islam flying over Buckingham Palace, and you've got Lord Ahmed saying he can't guarantee order in the streets if Wilders is allowed to show his film in the House of Lords, so he's lands at Heathrow and he's put on a plane and sent back. Can you give me any sort of explanation why not?
There's a, I think, important book written by the French philosopher Pascal Bruckner. In English, the title is The Tyranny of Guilt. And it sums up the answer.
Yeah.
Imperialism, fascism, racism. The Western world has done some pretty awful things. Indeed, arguably more awful than anyone else. Holocaust, for starters. And yet, at the same time, it's achieved some rather great things, too. But Europeans in general, and Britons in particular, feel a deep sense of guilt over what they've done. Now, you might say the British have done a whole lot less than the Germans have to deserve that sense of guilt, but nonetheless, it's very much there. The empire has its legacy. And there are some pretty nasty things done in the course of building that empire. And British were notoriously racist. Imperialist and racist, if not fascist. And I think guilt over that leads to a sense of diffidence, that we don't really have something that we can brag about. We don't really have something that's worth fighting for and dying for. We don't have something that's worth, never mind dying, just fighting for. We're talking about war here. We don't have something worth asserting. I think a key moment came, what, in 1969 with Enoch Powell's River of Blood speech, where this politician who had reasonable expectations of becoming prime minister was simply flushed out of the system and it was never heard from again. Because he was not talking about Islam, he was talking about racial issues, but without looking at the specifics of his speech, he was asserting British, traditional Britain, and his career ended right there. And I think no other politician has dared say anything similar. Anyway, I mean, it'd be different, it wouldn't be about race, it would be about Islam ever since. David Cameron did give a very eloquent speech on this subject about 4 years ago. But now that he's actually got something that he can do about it? So I think guilt. Guilt is the one word answer.